The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
What was probably unique and unprecedented was that, you know, in the case of Oliver North, he was supportive of the president, maybe to the detriment to his obligation to his oath to the Constitution, but he was basically at least aligned with the president there. Here, an active duty service member was at odds with the president, but aligned with the Constitution. That's a very unusual place to be. You'd think that those two would be completely aligned. So for me, it was a major concern. You know, what was my obligation? Was my obligation to the commander in chief or to the Constitution? I knew it was ultimately to the Constitution, but it was something that I had to wrestle with. It's something that the Army and the Department of Defense had to wrestle with also. And the way that they kind of dealt with it is they just sat it out, sat on the sidelines, didn't provide really any substantive support.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 23rd, 2020. Following his appearance on Friday on the Lawfare Podcast, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the Pritzker Military Fellow at the Lawfare Institute, had a live video conversation with the Lawfare audience on Lawfare Live. It was a very good conversation, so good that we thought we would bring you an edited version of it as part two of our conversation with Alex Vindman. We covered a lot of ground. How does one become an NSC director while serving in the active duty military? What risks does the transition period have in foreign relations? Does Vindman have any regrets about his decision to speak out during the impeachment, and lots, lots more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 23rd, a conversation with Alexander Vindman. All right, let's start with this question. How does the career path of an Army officer lead to the NSC?
Sure. The short answer is it doesn't, frankly. And that's why I feel like most of my contemporaries, most of my peers, and frankly, even my seniors don't really understand how a lieutenant colonel got himself mixed up into this.
You and Oliver North, man.
Yeah. yeah. Although I hate to be identified in that same.
Well, you were both. He was a Marine lieutenant colonel. Yeah. You were Army. But yeah.
So it's interesting. Because it's so atypical, I actually at one point, I'll start chronologically and work backwards. I had a senior retired naval admiral call me and not too long ago and kind of offer some support. And he got it because he had served on the NSC as a senior captain at one point and understood the role of a director on the NSC. That's what I was, a director on the NSC. On the order of precedence, and it sounds kind of odd to say for a lieutenant colonel, on the order of precedence, I basically ranked at the level of a deputy assistant secretary. So kind of like a two-star equivalent, which is, again, a very strange place to find yourself as a lieutenant colonel. But you don't carry your military rank on the NSC. I was director for Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Russia, specifically because, you know, the baggage of being lower ranked compared to the deputy assistant secretaries for the meetings I chaired. It would make it difficult to actually do my job. So with regards to me specifically, I think I just had an exceptionally fortunate run, an alignment of, you know, maybe some efforts on my part, but also the fact that the gods smiled on me and, you know, put me in the right positions. I started out my FAO career coming out of graduate school, going straight to the big show, going to Moscow. I served there for 3 years. I served there during kind of the quasi-Russian normal time period where we still had a military-to-military relationship. You know, I had a chance to participate in some exercises with Russian and U.S. forces. And then it went to, you know, complete basket case when the Russians decided to attack Ukraine, seize Crimea, and foster an insurgency in eastern Ukraine. So from there, having kind of those skill sets, spending a lot of time looking at Russia and what Russia was doing in Ukraine, I was hired to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, a Russia political military affairs officer. And at the same time, we were looking at, we had come around to the understanding that we had neglected our great power rivals for too long, and they had been taking advantage of that lack of attention and our focus on the wars on terror. And I drafted the co-authored the National Military Strategy Russia component and was a principal author for the Global Campaign Plan for Russia. And at the same time, I was a part of all of the committee meetings at the NSC, came to the attention of Fiona Hill, who is, you know, obviously one of the foremost Russia experts. And she asked me to join the team, which I did when I finished up my time on the joint staff. And that's how a that's how my career path unfolded. There are other folks that few and far in between. You have some regional expertise that kind of floats into the Middle East shop because people have a lot of operational experience that's useful. Russia hadn't had a FAO period there until for many years until I got there. I think there was a China FAO in the China Directorate. But that's really it. The bulk of the military staffing goes into the comm support for the White House Situation Room. It goes into the Defense Directorate. Of course, you would imagine you would have, you know, top tier military officers serving in the Defense Directorate as the interface between the rest of the government and the National Security Council, the White House, and Department of Defense, and so forth. So you find a fair number of folks. And I want to say that Oliver North, I'm pretty confident, was in that Defense Directorate. You know, hopefully there's nobody on that call from here, but we call those the kind of the second stringers, you know, not there.
Excellent.
Thank you. Good morning. It's an honor to talk to you, Colonel.
Thank you.
So the history of the NSC seems to amount to adding positions for cross-government coordination based on emerging crises or challenges. Pandemic advisor comes to mind. With the multiple crisis fight facing the Biden administration, to include one of my favorites, which is the blurring of foreign and domestic threats, does it make sense to once again plus up the staffing there? Okay. Or are there maybe other options for cross-government coordination that don't translate to adding focal points within the NSC?
So that's an excellent question, John. Frankly, I'm writing something about these the blurring of the foreign and domestic threats. And the way I'm couching what I'm thinking about is that solutions to domestic challenges actually have a significant amount of symmetry with the solutions that would be applicable to foreign challenges. So that, you know, just to address your interest there. Now, with regards to organization of the NSC, yes, traditionally there is, you know, there's always a tension between empowering the departments and agencies and leaving a limited coordinating function for the NSC. I think that made a lot of sense historically. When challenges were simpler, when we faced kind of like some very, very robust existential threats, but they were more narrow and focused, like communism and the Soviet Union or something of that nature. Now we face such a diverse array of threats, everything from climate change to, you know, regional issues with regional competitors, functional challenges in like cyberspace and so forth, that I believe, in fact, that the solution is a more empowered, balanced NSC that can serve the coordinating functions in all of these challenges, but without necessarily stepping on the toes of departments and agencies. That is a difficult thing to do because, again, the departments and agencies kind of want an honest broker in the NSC where the ideas come out of the departments and agencies and they get coordinated at the NSC. That's not actually the pattern that I experienced, and that's not the pattern I'd advocate for, which is sometimes departments and agencies tend to see things through a bit of a soda straw, and they don't maybe see the entire landscape. During my stint on the NSC, I put together, you know, a couple of action plans to address cross-cutting issues across departments and agencies. And then maybe I'll comment on President-elect Biden's preferences. So he had the opportunity to serve in a Obama NSC, which was the largest NSC that, you know, this country has had. And I have a feeling that he's going to look for something that he's familiar with and have an NSC that's quite robust and able to deal with these challenges. And at the same time, you know, without provoking some internecine battles between secretaries and NSC and White House staff.
The floor is yours.
Howdy. So I'm curious, with changing administrations, what are the biggest challenges for continuity in foreign policy, and what kind of tools have been developed to deal with that?
So the question is on continuity. Okay. There is a thread of continuity between the foreign policies of various administrations. If, you know, domestic policy has been relatively divergent and at odds over social issues, there's been what's referred to as the blob consensus, the foreign policy blob consensus on foreign policy issues. That is likely to be less so the case between the Trump and the Biden administration, but I would hope for some continuity still. So it's less likely to be in areas of certainly the way the president managed affairs, empowering and supporting adversaries and undermining allies. That's obviously going to be a total reversal there, and try to undo the damage done to our alliance structure and the confidence of our allies in the United States. It won't be entirely undone, because I think there'll be questions about, you know, whether there'll be a reversal again 4 years from now. But there'll be, for the next 4 years, we'll see kind of a more normative return. On the same note, though, I think there are things that the Trump administration has either planned, because you have a huge cohort of very capable folks within departments and agencies that are trying to do the right thing, or stumbled into some successes. And the recognition of kind of the rise of China and the nature of authoritarianism and how it is challenging the United States both abroad and domestically is not something that's likely to be reversed. As a matter of fact, I probably see a reasonable amount of continuity. I think it's going to be a much, much more coherent, logical, structured policy towards China. But it's not going to undo, you know, the fact that we will take a stronger line with regards to China using all sorts of different means and a lot of economic power to both coerce allies, our allies, to support Chinese objectives and support our adversaries with regards to, you know, kind of undergirding their own regimes. I don't think we're going to go to a kind of more softer, accommodating attack. It'll just be more coherent and logical, and maybe, you know, leverage our strengths and our alliances there.
All right. From a questioner who cannot come on, Colonel Vindman, thank you for your service. As you reflect back on the events of the last 16 months and knowing what happened after that fateful call, would you have done anything differently? And how have these events affected your personal and family life?
Yeah. So I think we tend to be a pretty resilient lot. I think my family and I have faced a number of challenges that we frankly assess to be maybe more challenging than even the past year. I've served in combat. We've served, my wife and I and our daughter lived in Moscow for 3 years. So we kind of rolled with the punches. You know, my biggest objective was, I knew that in the short term, there'd be a lot of challenges. I'd have to determine whether I stay in the military or move on and do something else. Ultimately, based on the president's campaign of intimidation, bullying, and retaliation, I moved on, and he picked a fight, politicized me, gave me a voice. I decided to use it, as you all may have noted, you know, in the lead up to the election. So that has not been without its challenges. It was very difficult for my wife, who, as my daughter says, is in charge of safety while I'm in charge of fun, to kind of deal with the reality of threats and deal with the reality of kind of hate mail coming to the house, although not that much. I mean, the massive majority, overwhelming majority was you know, supporting letters, but still the fact that we were potentially accessible, the fact that we may have had to move on, we were seriously considering moving on to an installation for force protection reasons. Those were things that we had to deal with, you know, all the way from yesterday, last year, until present to a certain extent. And then there were the kind of the life-changing decisions we had to make, again, circling back to whether I still had a military career, what was going to be, how I was going to provide for my family. Going through a very deliberate, to my wife's, you know, chagrin, it was maybe too deliberate, period of kind of analysis and talking to people to determine whether I had still had legs in the military. Part of it was also letting the system play out and not letting the president and the Department of Defense off the hook to see if they were going to do the right thing, put me on a promotion list, promote me. They didn't. So that played itself out to the end. And then when it became clear that things were going to wrap up with the military, you know, talking to folks like Ben, who's been an awesome counselor and friend and supporter, and a number of other folks to kind of determine where I wanted to focus. And right now, I guess I probably have, I've decided to go into too many directions. I'm a student at Johns Hopkins, working on a doctorate. I'm a fellow at Lawfare. I'm also, I've got some commitments with UPenn as a non-resident fellow, doing some consulting work, a lot of different things. But to me, it makes sense because I guess I still don't know exactly where I want to put my energies. I know I want to continue to serve, and it gives me a couple of years to do something that I really am keen on, passionate about, expanding my knowledge and studying, and deciding where I want to go after, you know, a couple of years and when some of these things kind of come to resolution. So,
all right, joining from Finland.
Oh, hello. Hello, Ben. Hello, Alex.
Hi.
So my question is, do you believe that the Arctic Council should widen its horizons to include security matters in the future? And could it serve as an alternate means of finding solutions when, for example, the Security Council gets bogged down? And also, as a Finn and with historic interests, do you believe that with what's happening in the Ukraine has some relevance to what took place in Finland and in the Baltic states in the early years of the Second World War? Because when the event started in Ukraine, it seemed eerily familiar to me.
Sure. So maybe starting with the Arctic Council, I think whether we want it to go there or not, and right now it's supposed to be kind of, there's a good term of art for it, which is escaping me, but it's supposed to be a organization that looks for commonalities rather than issues that are going to be divisive, to put it in artfully. But that is not likely to be the case. I think the fact is that Russia is going to continue to assert a privileged sphere of influence over the Arctic. They've already implemented a number of regulations and constraints on North Sea route transit. I think those are likely to continue to expand. There's all sorts of maneuvering for the Arctic shelf and determining who has the exclusive economic zone that's going to have security implications. China, with its construction of more icebreakers, is going to increasingly become competitive as the resources that are still untapped become the targets of attention, whether that's natural resources in the form of oil and gas that are hard to get to, or fisheries and so forth. I think these all bring, we've seen this play out elsewhere. For instance, in the South China Sea and East China Sea, there's quite a bit of competition over the fisheries that China tapped because it's actually expended a lot of the near seas fisheries, and that's brought a confrontation with both the Philippines and Japan. So those things are likely to pay out. We should never exclude the security components of any activity. You know, I think Europe's detriment, they initially overlooked the security components of, let's say, energy and what the implications are of Nord Stream 2. So I think those are, it's unrealistic to not see drift in that direction. At the same time, there are probably a lot of ways that you could potentially cooperate, because there will be commercial transit through there. There could be some accommodation and understanding that is arrived to as Russia's still potent, but relatively diminishing resources with kind of, for instance, the construction of Chinese icebreakers makes it a little bit more challenging for the Russians to kind of exclude other actors. So I think, you know, that's enough on the Arctic Council. With regards to Ukraine, I think that you could draw comparisons to the early World War II period. You could actually draw comparisons to the kind of World War I period, post-World War I period, you know, after Russia signed the Brest-Litovsk Treaty and, left the war and then proceeded to, at the conclusion of the war, try to recapture lost territory. I think you could kind of see a coherent revisionist streak where the Russians, in when they feel the strength, will assert military might, kind of the rules of the jungle, and pursuing might makes right type policies. And when they're relatively weak, they will kind of focus more inward and try to build strength to assert themselves in the future. We saw that initially play out in Georgia as well as Ukraine. I think there is a much, much higher threshold to try to push against the Baltic states, which they would have, of course, loved to do if the Baltics were not part of NATO. But the threats of kind of a escalation in hostilities are too high for the Russians to push there. But where NATO isn't, where states are vulnerable, you could expect to see some assertion of Russian rights. What will be interesting for me to see is how Russia chooses to behave in Central Asia, where they have retained quite a bit of influence, but now you have Chinese influence increasing. And as those states kind of are forced in the position of making some tougher choices based on economic opportunities, how Russia responds to China's growing influence in the region. But I see it unfolding in kind of much the same way. Where there's a power vacuum, they'll step in.
All right. The floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you. So I guess you started to get at this a little bit with the previous question, but what do you make of the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine? And do you have any thoughts about Russia's use of gray zone warfare and whether or not it's been as successful as some people have given it credit for?
So I think that Russia is generally satisfied with the current situation in eastern Ukraine. They have what amounts in their view to frozen conflict, although it's not entirely frozen. It's flared up multiple times since the front line stabilized, but it probably has enough there to continue to influence the internal affairs of Ukraine and to apply pressure when they need to. It is unlikely that unless there is a really significant shift in terms of President Zelensky's policies and NATO EU outreach on Ukraine, that things are going to really change dramatically. Over the long run, it's Ukraine's prosperity, the implementation of reforms and anti-corruption measures that will make Ukraine stronger and potentially entice Eastern Ukraine, which, don't get me wrong, it's the Russians that control it, but they have some support from the domestic population there now, which has been frightened to believing that, you know, they'll be murdered or something by Ukrainian nationalists. But as they see that prosperity and some outreach from Kiev, they might warm back up to the idea of Russia with its limited resources and limited support is not the place where Eastern Ukraine wants to be.
Are you going to become defense minister of Ukraine?
I mean, I three times and I'm out, right? If I denied it three times, I'm out. Yeah, that's a funny one. I like that one. So the gray zone, I think Russia has actually, in fact, been highly effective in the gray zone. And there are different types of terms for it. Gray zone, hybrid warfare, competition below the level of armed conflict is the way that we prefer to kind of address it. Everything short of kind of a hot war in our context. So what has that allowed them to do? It's allowed them to seize Crimea. It's allowed them to minimize the costs of the incursions into eastern Ukraine. And, when they needed to dominate Ukrainian military forces with some limited kind of plausible deniability and without using air power, they used UAVs, they used kind of electronic warfare, they used a lot of indirect fire to achieve their military effects. cyber warfare as a tool. This isn't just Ukraine. You know, we're experiencing this actually in a lot of these, some of these lower non-military means in the United States with our allies, cyber attacks, cyber infiltrations, illicit finance. These are all kind of gray zone and to me, maybe the biggest hazard, which is information operations, which I'll get into in a second, have been pretty significant challenges. The reason that information operations I consider to be one of the bigger challenges is because there are a lot of issues that democracies are facing, both the U.S. and our allies are facing. Those have to do with the kind of the isms, nationalism, ethnocentric nationalism, systemic racism, as well as the inequities of globalization and growing inequality that have not been sufficiently well addressed that the Russians could then exploit with regards to information operations. You know, you have to have something there in order for the Russians to come in and exploit these challenges, but there's enough where the Russians have been pretty successful in further driving polarization and working with populists in Hungary, Poland, Turkey, and even the U.S., I say working in kind of the loosest sense, working in concert with populists' own kind of demagoguery, they're able to really, drive some outcomes that are pretty favorable. Some of those outcomes include continuing to distract the United States because of internal divisions. So the U.S. is focused on internal issues. It's not going to have the resources and the bandwidth to kind of address, Russia challenges, except for the most acute ones. The breeding of fear that Russia is a near peer threat and kind of elevating them to kind of, you know, their former position as a superpower rival. They're not there, but they're able to make outsized investments that provide huge returns with regards to information operations. The gray zone is an effective place for them to be. It's very asymmetric. It doesn't kind of seek to challenge us with a, you know, high cost arms race. It looks to undermine our, you know, our relative weaknesses and drive divisions. So I think it's the place where our adversaries will always try to play.
The floor is yours.
Good evening, Colonel. Someone who personally had the privilege to serve in the State Department alongside great military officers in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, and Jordan. I want to thank you for your exemplary service. In your impeachment hearing testimony, you had a message for your late father. Do not worry, I will be fine for telling the truth. How do you feel about that assurance now with everything you have been through since? And how do we get back to honoring that pledge for all who choose public service?
Sure. Honestly, I feel pretty good about it. I think the reason I could say that is that I never really took it as kind of a superficial comment about Here Right Matters, which, by the way, is the title of my forthcoming memoir. So while I wasn't particularly concerned about raising my concerns with inside the White House through the proper channels. I knew, of course, once I was, you know, thrust into the public eye, both in the closed door testimony and the public testimony, there would be consequences. I kind of understood the various possibilities of consequences. I kind of mainly focused on the fact that I'd be leaving the White House and there would be a stigma associated with my tenure there. I had concerns about whether I would still have a military career, but I was hopeful, maybe naively so. But I also knew that if I needed to do something else, I was at the 21-year mark or so, you know, 20, over 20 when this whole thing started to unfold. But, you know, 21-year mark when I had to start making some hard decisions, I knew I frankly had a little bit of a cushion with regards to pension. I had, I'd have some health benefits and so forth. So I knew that if I had to start over, I had the requisite tools to be okay and wind up fine in the kind of the long term. And I guess I made the decision that, you know, these were certainly consequences I was more than willing to bear based on the import of the moment and the need to hold everybody accountable, including the President of the United States. While I wasn't going to be making a decision on it, and I recognize that the Senate would acquit, no party has kind of dismissed the president. I mean, the president hasn't been dismissed, period, in this manner, but no party would remove him. That wasn't my decision. My role was to provide testimony, and if that wasn't going to have an effect in the Senate trial, it would kind of expose the misdeeds of the president and maybe play itself out in the election. So as far as I'm concerned, the president was impeached and removed.
Just not in a single process.
Yes.
The floor is yours. Good to see you.
You too. Thank you for having me. Transitions between administrations are pretty top of mind. What are a few things you think the U.S. can do to prepare for President Putin stepping down if he does so?
Yeah, that's so we might have to wait for a long time, potentially to 2036. Although I don't know if it's necessarily going to be that long. There have been all sorts of kind of internal maneuvering to secure an enduring role for President Putin, even if he's not in the in the office of the president. These are the discussions on empowering the prime ministership or the Security Council or so forth. But let's just take it at face value and believe that he's going to be certainly in power until 2036. He's already been in power for 20 years. I think the outlines of our relationship with Russia are likely to hew in the same manner until he's out of power. There are probably some understandings and some accommodations that could be made. I believe that the future policy should include more energized engagement, as well as, well, let's just call it kind of containing Russia's malign influence and aggression track. So what that might look like is somewhere within the first year or so, there are a number of meetings that lead to a presidential engagement between President Biden and Putin, and that kind of sets the ground rules for the remainder of President Biden's tenure. And those ground rules include something closer to, look, Russia, if you're going to employ gray zone tactics, information operations against the United States domestically, we have not done that. In spite of your rhetoric on, color revolutions, we have not done that. But we will pursue a policy of deterring this kind of aggression, and it will be a policy of reciprocity for Russian actions. It is not the most comfortable place for us to be. We tend to be principled, and that's the place we want to operate in. But we do need to achieve some deterrence there. So I think an engagement track that kind of establishes the rules of the game is going to be critical. At the same time, there should be something that imposes costs for, the last 4 years and more of Russian attacks on the United States. Once we get past that, what I would like to see is a policy in which we kind of declare a cost for Russian behavior and then leave it in the Russians' court. If they pursue an aggressive policy, if they attack us, they know exactly what they're going to get in response. And it would be something that would be ideal if we could do it in concert with our allies. So we pass legislation that imposes a series of costs. It's on the books. And all it requires is Russia's action in the negative, some sort of negative action in order to implement it. And they know, again, what that threshold is pretty clearly. And we continue to apply a significant amount of resources for hardening NATO, hardening democracies, pulling together our closest allies to deal with these challenges that the Russians have been particularly effective in deploying. So it's multifaceted, that looks to support our strengths, punish Russia for its transgressions, and also engage with them to make sure that they understand what the rules are.
The floor is yours.
So I think you actually briefly touched on this in a previous question, but I'm wondering if you feel like there were certain structures or protections that you had in your position that other people might not, that allowed you to come forward and be a whistleblower, or if a lot of people have these protections and just maybe it takes an American by choice to, wish for an America that lives up to the marketing material.
Yeah. So in many ways, I would say I had maybe less protections than other folks, those protections that others have are really functional under the Trump administration, where basically no rule can't be transgressed easily enough. by the dismissal of an IG or something of that nature. But in fact, at the White House, I even more so than a regular military officer, I serve at the pleasure of the president. I don't have an IG channel where I could take my concerns to. I have a legal shop that's actually there was created to provide oversight for the NSC, but it is filled by, the senior elements are filled by political actors that offer less protection. And I'll give you, some concrete examples here. So when I took my concerns to NSC legal, dual head at his White House counsel, that they would basically provide the president counsel that what he's proposing is illegal and highly problematic, at minimum, probably illegal. And that was going to get the president to kind of, based on the legality, to reverse course. He ultimately did when exposed and when a series of House committees investigated him. But that was my intent. That was really in terms of channels. That's as most as I can do, except in exercising the NSC process, the National Security Policy Memorandum 4 basically outlines principals committees, deputies committees, policy planning committees, and then at my level, sub-policy planning committees. In addition to taking that concern over to the legal shop, I also leveraged the process that was established to build consensus amongst the interagencies all the way up through the deputies level. And then a national policy, a presidential decision memo with the concerted views of the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, recommending a reversal on the hold of security assistance, and meeting with Zelensky. The whistleblower basically saw the world in a slightly different view. He assessed that whatever complaints I had made weren't going to be sufficient, and he took his complaints similarly to the CIA IG. And that should have went to, went through a process and basically and eventually resulted in House Intel Committee, the HPSI's oversight role being triggered and looking into this. CIA IG proceeded to have a conversation with the same people I complained to and pretty much squashed this, squashed the concerns. The whistleblower recognizing this then went to the ODNI IG, elevated there. And the ODNI IG did the right thing and, it was circulated through the leadership, ODNI leadership, and over to the House committees. And that's how the Ukraine scandal was exposed through through the hearings. What I find interesting about this is that the system, frankly, worked a lot like designed. I took my complaints to the right channels. Other folks took their complaints to their right channels. Those ultimately percolated up to the legislative branch and their oversight role, and that exposed the president's wrongdoings, and the president was impeached. So I think it's people doing the right thing, as individuals, living up to their oaths and their obligations that allowed this situation to unfold. So that's at the professional level. Of course, we saw the countervailing force of politicals subverting the system, refusing to appear when called and so forth, and trying to subvert the system, but it worked.
And how do you, just before we go to the next question, how do you assess the role of your boss, John Bolton? On the one hand, he kind of backed you in the moment, right? On the other hand, he is one of the people who didn't show up when requested to testify, and left it to you and Fiona and the others to take the president's wrath. And then he, got a lot of money for a book based on the same information that he should have given to Congress. Like, what's your take on all of that?
So it's what I would say is that he's a survivor. He's a political operative. He backed us when the cost was like negligible. I mean, I was part of the NSC. John Eisenberg was part of the NSC. Michael Ellis was part of the NSC. All he was doing was providing direction that we were not going to participate in, the machinations of you know, drug Giuliani deals. Drug deals. So the problem is that, you know, he also was not going to fall. He had a larger portfolio, but he wasn't going to fall on a sword over a hold on aid to Ukraine. He was going to do the best he could to reverse it, but that was not going to be, you know, where he was going to resign. He obviously made that decision with regards to the Taliban going to Camp David on the anniversary of 9/11. You know, so that was probably a good place to that's the hill to die on, reasonably. I think Mattis made a similar call with regards to withdrawal of troops in Syria. Actually had a positive effect there in terms of at least holding, to some semblance of policy. You could argue if you're a Syria a policy guy that, you know, that was a good place for him to be. I don't know, as a great power competition guy, if we need to be applying our resources to the Middle East to the exclusion of, you know, other challenges with regards to Russia and China. But you could make a reasonable case for that. So I guess the bottom line is that there are a number of political actors that could have done more to live up to their oaths and defend democracy for their own calculations, whether it's self-enrichment, other folks because they didn't want to harm a reputation or harm the ability to, you know, engage with in a bipartisan matter with Republicans or Democrats. I think you could sense where I'm going with this, or, you know, jeopardized board positions may have gone in a different way than you would expect them to do as former senior military officers or as public servants that have sworn oath. What I have confidence in, faith in, is that I think many of my peers would have probably done the same thing. At least I hope that they would do the same thing. And if they saw some sort of, criminal act, they would report it, you know, make a correction to it. But that's a tough question. All right.
Hello. Honored to speak with you, sir. So I was wondering, in the current conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, do you see Russia's current involvement in bringing the two parties to the table as much as they have to be at all beneficial? Or do you think that it would complicate our voice at all moving forward in the region if we tried to take a bigger...
Sure. I think it would be hard for us to take a big role now. We sat out on the sidelines during the kind of most acute phase of this crisis, and all those existing channels, because there were multiple processes, Minsk groups, and so forth, that, you know, just were not employed during this particular, or not to little effect. And ultimately, you know, facts on the ground, the Azeris' successful military operations brought the Armenians to the negotiating table, and that discussion was moderated by the Russians. I think this is it's interesting that, in some strange way, I kind of sense a more permanent and stable outcome to Nagorno-Karabakh as a frozen conflict between at least Armenia and Azerbaijan. Russia is going to be there as peacekeepers. They're not likely to go anywhere soon, but it might not be in the form of a kind of a frozen conflict. You know, if you look at the history of that particular portion, that sub-region between Azerbaijan and Armenia, it's been contested for a long time. The Armenians were able to exercise military force to secure really fairly large swaths of Azerbaijan's territory. And probably, if you look at the map and the ethnic makeups of those provinces and their areas where the Armenians were not dominant, they were kind of Azeri territories. The Azeris, with their massive investment in military technology and military capabilities, were able to reverse a lot of those acquisitions and pretty much constrain Armenia to their kind of their places that they're most concerned about in NK, Stepankirk and the surrounding province. So what that leads to is kind of almost a satisfactory outcome. Armenia has access. This is a 5-mile corridor to that area. And Azerbaijan kind of achieved its military aims and reclaimed some territory. So I think as far as Azerbaijan is concerned, they're satisfied. Armenia is not obviously satisfied. They perceive Azerbaijan as the aggressor. In this case, that's probably right. But they retained, the Armenians retained kind of the areas that they were most concerned about. What that could lead to, though, in the long run, is potentially Armenia normalizing relationships with Turkey, and that could lead to an economic prosperity that the Armenians haven't been able to enjoy since the fall of the Soviet Union. You know, that's a little bit off of what you asked for. I will circle back and end with the fact that the Russians ended up conducting the negotiations. They'll have 1,600 troops in the region. They've increased their influence, certainly in Armenia, and probably reversed kind of reversed Pashinyan's, well, it's too early to say, but reverse Pashinyan's kind of democratic velvet revolution, that he's likely to be out of power sooner rather than later, and return kind of to the more traditional vested interests. So Russia's, you know, is going to hold its place and expand its place in the region that way.
Hi, thank you. Given that you were an active duty army officer at the time of the impeachment proceedings, I'm wondering to what extent considerations relating to civil-military relations played into your decisions about whether to speak, how to speak, and what to say ultimately.
Sure, they absolutely did. What was probably unique and unprecedented was that, you know, in the case of Oliver North, he was supportive of the president, maybe to the detriment to his obligation to his oath to the Constitution, but he was basically at least aligned with the president there. Here, an active duty service member was at odds with the president, but aligned with the Constitution. That's a very unusual place to be. You'd think that those two would be completely aligned. So for me, it was a major concern. You know, what was my obligation? Was my obligation to the commander in chief or to the Constitution? I knew it was ultimately to the Constitution, but it was something that I had to wrestle with. It's something that the Army and the Department of Defense had to wrestle with also. And the way that they kind of dealt with it is they just sat it out, sat on the sidelines, didn't provide really any substantive support. The only thing I got was, at one point, I had a comment from somebody from the senior-most Army officer, which was, do the right thing in the right way. And I'm like, great, I know what the right thing is. What's the right way? I think, you know, it's a little off track, but I'll briefly mention that the biggest challenge of civil relations right now are that, you know, we're relying not on civilian control and oversight of the military, but a reliable military that's going to adhere to its oath to the Constitution. Because we, you know, even in the past week or so, we've had major changes in, or a little more than, but major changes in the staffing in the White House, and we can't potentially trust those political actors that we expect to have civilian oversight of the military. So that's going to be a longstanding issue that we'll have to work through.
The floor is yours.
Thanks. So my question's pretty wonky, though I do appreciate a good CivMil shout out. We talk about Russian disinformation so much here in the States and forget that, like, we exist not in a vacuum, right? Eurodefender 2020 was essentially canceled, right? This joint NATO operation was essentially canceled because of COVID. But had it happened, it was facing an enormous deluge of Russian disinformation and a real lack of support across Europe. So I guess my question is really, like, what do we do about this? Why does it matter? And as we think about this outside of just the U.S., like, we have interests that are not just our elections. That's my question.
So this is something that I've been thinking through. And I think the fact is that we and our allies face a lot of the same challenges. A lot of them are with regards to Russian information confrontation. And I think what we probably need to do is have some sort of democracy summit and take a look at best practices and to face these challenges. I think you're right that there was an enormous amount of Russian propaganda about Defender 2020. But what I find more interesting is that, you know, when we as specialists focus on something narrow as an exercise, we miss massive tapestry of reporting that's really amounts to anti-Russian reporting about Russian misdeeds. So in the broader picture, you know, the aggregate of all of Russia's misdeeds get reported, and that's tends to be a much more negative picture. But if we look at it with regards to one particular exercise, you know, it looks like they're having more success with regards to undermining the credibility of that exercise. We probably need to operationalize. We spend a lot of time talking about information operations countering Russian information operations, we do a much, much worse job of operationalizing our actions there. I think there's a long conversation to be had there, maybe at some other time.
You get the penultimate question today.
Okay. To make it very short, we're in a period of transition from a president who has shuffled the his friendships internationally. We have a new leadership in the Defense Department, and there's 60 days until the new president comes in. How worried should we be about an invasion of Ukraine or something occurring in Asia or someone wanting to take advantage of their opportunity with Trump?
Yeah. In aggregate, probably we should be significantly worried with specific kind of existing scenarios, less so. Like, for instance, Putin has a lot of what he needs in Ukraine. We're probably not going to see something there. I think it's the places that we're not maybe mindful of so much that there are some risks, unforeseen risks, places that we're not attentive to, places where the rules haven't been kind of set. You know, if there's an escalation in Ukraine, there's likely to be a response with regards to sanctions. So I think our adversaries in general are looking for opportunities. Taiwan also, I don't necessarily think that, you know, that would be a huge costly play for the Chinese. And if anything, kind of set the template for a very hostile relationship with Biden administration going forward. There's a lot of different places, I guess.
So not Taiwan, not Ukraine, but somewhere.
I think I don't know if I wouldn't say it's guaranteed to happen, but the probability of it happening now in this, you know, what we're experiencing in the next 60 days is higher than it has been or is likely to be under a future Biden administration. But, you know, those calculations are very, very complex and the costs tend to be high. There has to be some sort of triggering event.
You get the last question today.
Thank you very much. It better be good. How would you assess the danger that Russia poses to the West today in comparison to the danger that was posed by the communist USSR? And connected to that, do you think the character of the danger has changed? Is the character more cultural, social, religious than it is directly political? So is the West being upended more today than it would have been, say, 40 years ago?
Yeah. So that's an excellent question to end on, actually. I would say that Russia specifically opposes a much smaller threat than it did. But authoritarian states as a whole pose a much, much greater challenge, I think, in a lot of ways. I mean, it's less in terms of military and existential, but it's more in terms of kind of which system of government is likely to endure. I was looking at kind of just some basic numbers. In 92, the G20 democratic states accounted for 94% of the GDP. In 2019, they account for 62%. 38% of the GDP of the G20 is now held by authoritarian states. That is a massive shift in terms of resources, a massive shift in terms of what kind of alternative view of prosperity exists. So I think it's a question of whether democracy continues to ascend, the era of democracy, you know, is preserved, or do we return to kind of pre-18th century autocratic states where kind of the elites tend to rule and, you know, pass out some benefits to their populace. So in that regard, it's as an existential crisis and systemic crisis, it's just probably is not necessarily in the military sphere right now.
We're going to leave it there. Alex Vindman, welcome to Lawfare and welcome to civilian life. And we will be hearing a great deal from you. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast. Tweet about us, share us on Facebook and other social media, and leave us a rating or review wherever you found us. You can get Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.